Today we will go through a reading of a sermon by Andrew Gray. And the title of the sermon is simply A Sermon Concerning Death. It is taken from Psalm 89, verse 48. Psalm 89, verse 48 says, "What man is he that liveth and shall not see death? Shall he deliver his soul from the hand of the grave? Selah." It is very hard to determine where all that are here shall be within 30 years. For even before that time come, many, if not all of us who are here, shall have taken up our everlasting lodging. And whether we shall take it up in the eternity of joy or in the eternity of pain is also hard to determine. Only this one thing I am sure of, that all of us shall shortly be gone, and before long the shadows of death shall be sitting upon our eyelids, and our eye strings shall begin to break. Therefore, I would the more seriously ask you, what would you think if death were approaching this night unto you? Do you think that Jesus Christ has gone up to prepare a place for you, even for you? Surely, I think we are all near to eternity. And there are some hearing me today whom I defy the world to assure that ever they shall hear another sermon. And therefore I exhort you all to hear this preaching, as if it were the last preaching that you should ever hear. And oh, that we would speak it, as if it were the last sermon that ever we would preach unto you. Believe me, death is a different thing than we take it to be. Oh, what will many of us do in the day of our visitation, when desolation shall come from afar? Where will we flee for rest, and where will we leave our glory? Old rich men, where will you flee when death assaults you? And old poor men, where will you flee when death assaults you? And old women, where will you flee when death assaults you? And young women, where will you flee when death assaults you? It was an ancient observation of David from Psalm 39, verse 5, that God had made his days as a handbreadth. This either may relate to the fourfold state of man, namely his infancy, his childhood, his manhood, and his old age, or it may relate to the fourfold time of his life, namely his morning, his forenoon, his afternoon, and his evening. Yet all our lifetime is but a day. And do you not think that our day is near to an end? Now before that I begin to speak anything from the words read in the beginning, I shall speak a few things to these two questions, which I conceive may not altogether be unprofitable. Question one. Whether it is lawful for any to desire to die and to return unto their long and endless home, whether it be lawful for one to cry out, "O time, time, flee away, and all my shadows let them be gone, that so long an eternity may come." And here's the answer. I say it is lawful in some cases for one to desire to die. For it was Paul's desire in Philippians 1:23, where he says, "I am in a strait betwixt two, having a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better." And also in 2 Corinthians 5:2, where it says, "We groan earnestly, desiring to be clothed upon with our house which is from heaven." Now I long greatly till the 21st year of my age come, when my minority shall be overpassed, that I may be entered heir to that matchless inheritance. But to clear in what cases it is lawful to desire to die, first I say, it is lawful to desire to die when it flows from a desire of uninterrupted fellowship and communion with Christ in conjunction with Him. This is clear from 2 Corinthians 5:6. Knowing that whilst we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord. Therefore, verse 8, we are willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. Also, it is clear from Philippians 1:23, I am in a strait betwixt two, having a desire to depart and to be with Christ, which is far better. It was his great end to have a near and unmixed communion with Christ. Now, what ails you, Paul might one have said. Are you not content to stay here a while? No, says Paul. I desire to be gone and to be with Christ. Were you never with him here, Paul? I have been with him, he says. But what is all my being with him here in comparison of my being with him above? Whilst I am present in the body, I am absent from the Lord. Therefore, I will never be at rest, he says, get what I will, until I get Christ, until I get those naked and immediate embracings of that noble plant of renown, the flower of the stock of Jesse, who is the light of the higher house and the eternal admiration of angels. Secondly, it is lawful to desire to die when it flows from the excellencies of heaven, from a desire to partake of those excellent things that are there. This is clear from 2 Corinthians 5:4. We groan being burdened, for as the word is, we groan as they who are pressed under a heavy burden, that we may be clothed upon, that mortality might be swallowed up with life. What ails you to groan in this way, Paul? Oh, he says, I groan that mortality may be swallowed up of life. Number three, it is lawful to desire to die when it flows from a desire to be saved from the body of death and from those temptations that assault us and from those oppressions whereunto we are subject by it. Doubtless, Paul desired to die on this account when he cried out in Romans 7:24, O wretched man that I am! Who shall deliver me from the body of this death? He longed greatly for that day, wherein he shall be made white like the wings of a dove, covered with silver, whose feathers are of yellow gold. Oh, says Paul, I am as one impatient, till I be above, where I shall be clothed with those excellent and clean robes, the righteousness of Christ. And oh, says Paul, I think every day to be as a year, till I be possessed of that kingdom where Satan cannot tempt, and the creature cannot yield, and where I shall be free from all my fears of sinning. Now, in all these respects, who would not desire to die? But to guard all these, I would give you these four cautions. The first caution. Your desire to die should not be self-willed, but you should desire to die with a submission to the will of God, so that although He would fill up 15 more years to your life, you should be content to live it out. And the second caution. When your desires are hasty and offhand, suspect them. For some, when they meet up with an outward cross, without any deliberation, will cry out, "Oh, to be gone! Oh, that I were dead!" But your desire to die should be deliberate, not hasty or rash. The third caution. It is not lawful to desire to die because of personal afflictions. Many, when they meet with bitter afflictions, will cry out, "Oh, to be gone!" And they long for death even upon that account. Such was Job's desire in chapter 6, verses 8 and 9, where he said, "Oh, that I might have my request, even that it would please God to destroy me." This desire was very unlawful. And the fourth and final caution. It is not lawful to desire to die when your predominant idol is taken away from you. Yet such was Jonah's desire in chapter 4:3. Jonah thought his credit and his reputation, which was his idol, was gone and could never be regained. Therefore, he wished to die. But I would say this to you, that some will have 10 desires for death when they have not one desire for heaven. And what moves Christians to be so desirous to die? It is not so much because of their hope as because of their anxiety. It is not so much because of their confidence as because of their impatience. But I say unto you, when your desires of death are not accompanied with the desires of heaven, suspect them. Secondly, I would say this, that there are some who will have 10 desires for death when they will not have one for the death of the body of death. But it were good for you who are such to be desiring the death of the body of death. Then you would be in a more suitable frame to desire to die. And third, some will have hearty desires to die, and yet when death comes, they will be as unwilling to die as any. It has been observed that some who have much desire to die, when death came, have cried out, "Oh, spare a little, that I may recover strength." There is a great difference between a desire to die and death itself. It is a very easy thing to desire to die, but it is a very great business to meet with death and to look it in the face when it comes. We think death, before it comes near us, to be but child's play. But when we meet with it, it makes us change our thoughts, for it is a great business to die. Now, our second question is this. Is it lawful for a Christian to desire to live when he is summoned to die? Here's the answer. In some cases, it is lawful for a Christian to desire to live even when he is summoned to die, which is clear from the practice of David in Psalm 39:13, where he prays that the Lord would spare him a little. It is also clear from the practice of good Hezekiah in Isaiah 38:3, when he was commanded to set his house in order, for he should die and not live. And he cried out, "Remember now, O Lord, how I have walked before thee in truth and with a perfect heart, and have done that which is good in thy sight." And Hezekiah wept sore. Or as the words are in the original, he wept with a great weeping. But to guard this, take these two cautions. Here is the first caution. Your desire to live when you are summoned to die should not be self-willed, but instead should be with submission to the will of God, that if it is His pleasure to remove you presently out of time, that you should be content to die. And the second caution is this. Your desire to live should have gracious principles, and also a very gracious end, as is most clear from David in Psalm 39:13, where he said, "Oh, spare me a little, that I may recover strength, before I go hence and be no more." His desire to live was that he might have victory over his idols, as if he had said, "My desire to live is that I may have strength to wrestle with and to overcome my idols." And without all controversy, Hezekiah's desire was a most precious and well-grounded desire. However, I would say this unto you, that you should examine your desires to live as much, if not more, as your desires to die. For we are ready to shun death if we could. But He is that universal King unto whom all of us must be subject before long. Now in the words which were read unto you, there are six things which might be clearly observed from them. First, that it is a most clear and infallible truth that all persons shall once see death, as is clear in these words, "Who is he that liveth and shall not see death?" Secondly, that this truth, that we shall once see death, is not much believed or thought upon by many. Therefore it is that the psalmist doubles the assertion. "What man is he that liveth and shall not see death? Shall he deliver his soul," that is his life, "from the hand," that is from the power of the grave? Thirdly, that sometimes a Christian may win to a solid faith of this truth, that once he must die. This the psalmist got unto, as is also clear in that word, "Who is he that liveth and shall not see death?" And fourthly, that the certainty of this, that once we shall die, should be kept in our mind. Therefore, that note of attention, Selah, is put to it, as if he had said, "Take heed, that there is none living that shall not die." And fifthly, that howbeit some persons put the evil day far away, as if they were not to see death, yet is the day coming when they shall see death, and death shall take them by the hand. And sixthly, we shall take notice of this from the context that the Christian, who is much in minding the brevity of his life, will believe the certainty of his death. The psalmist was speaking of the shortness of his life in the preceding verse, and in this verse he speaks of the certainty of death. Now, as for the first of these things observed, namely, that it is certain and sure that we shall all once die, I hope there are none of you here who will deny it. Although I confess some of you believe what was said by the woman of Tekoa in 2 Samuel 14:14, "We must all die and be like water spilt upon the ground that cannot be gathered up again. God does not accept the person of any." Or as in Job 30:23, "I know that thou wilt bring me to death and to the house appointed for all living." And it is very clear in Ecclesiastes 8:8, "There is no man that hath power over the spirit to retain the spirit, neither hath he power in the day of death. And there is no discharge in that war. Neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. And it is also clear in Hebrews 9:27. It is appointed unto men once to die. So that it is most clear that we must die. I remember of one Philip, king of Macedonia, who had a substitute for this very end to cry at his chamber door every morning. Memento mori, memento mori, memento mori, remember, thou art to die. And it is reported to have been the practice of the nobles of Greece in the day whereon their emperor was crowned, that they presented a marble stone unto him. And he was asked after what fashion he would have his tombstone made. Which practice speaks forth this unto us, that although these were most destitute of the light of the Scripture, they were very mindful of death. Believe me, death may surprise us before we be aware. For it is most certain that we must die. But there is nothing more uncertain than the way how and the time when we shall die. Death will surprise some, as it did Abel in the open field in Genesis 4:8. Death will surprise some, as it did Eglon in his parlor in Judges 3:21. And death will surprise some, as it did Saul and Jonathan in the fight in 1 Samuel 31. Now, in speaking to this point, I shall first speak a little to those advantages which attend those that live within the continual sight of death. Secondly, I shall give you some considerations to press you to prepare for death. And thirdly, I shall give you some direction to help you to prepare for death. And then we shall proceed to the second point of doctrine, which we observe from the text. And I shall speak a few things from it unto you, and so come to a close for this time. First, then, we conceive that there are these seven advantages which attend those who live within the continual sight of this truth, that they must die. First, the faith of an approaching death will make a soul exceedingly diligent in duty. And this was our blessed Lord's divinity. In John 9:4, he said, I must work the work of him that sent me while it is day. The night cometh when no man can work. That is, death is approaching. Therefore, I must work. It is clear also in 2 Peter 1:12, compared with verse 14, which says, Wherefore, I will not be negligent to put you always in remembrance of these things, though you know them, and be established in the present truth. Yea, I think it meet, as long as I am in this tabernacle, to stir you up by putting you in remembrance, knowing that shortly I must put off this, my tabernacle, even as our Lord Jesus Christ has showed me. In the 12th verse, Peter is exceedingly diligent in his duty. And the ground of his diligence is in the 14th verse, knowing that shortly I must put off my tabernacle. Yea, it is even the Epicure's argument when he says, Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we shall die. And should not the Christian much more cry out, Let me watch and pray, for tomorrow I may die? I say if the Epicures did make use of this notion to make them vigorous in the pursuit of the pleasures, how much more should a Christian improve it for making him vigorous in the pursuit of his duty? And therefore I say unto you all, O be diligent, for your night is drawing near. O Christians and expectants of heaven, Are you not afraid lest you be overtaken before you have walked half of your journey? For if you be overtaken on your journey to heaven before you come to the end of your race, there is no retiring place whereunto you may turn aside to lodge. And therefore, work, work, and work while it is day. For behold, death is approaching. And then we shall all be called to an account. Number two. The faith of approaching death will make a Christian exceedingly active in duty. He will not only be diligent, but also exceedingly serious and zealous in the exercise of his duty. And this is clear from that notable exhortation of Ecclesiastes 9:10. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with all thy might. And the reason is, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. Wherefore, be active while you are alive, for you shall never work any more after you are dead. And if you leave but one work undone, there is no doing of it after death. There is no work, says Solomon, in the grave. Therefore, be active. Number three, the faith of this truth, that we all must die, will help a Christian to be exceedingly mortified to the things of this present world. O covetous men and women, if you would shake hands with cold death but once every morning, I would defy you to pursue the world so much as you do. Paul was much in the meditation of his change, which made him in 2 Corinthians 4:18 to overlook those things that are temporary. But we look not, says he, at the things which are seen, which are temporal, but at the things which are not seen, which are eternal. And therefore, in chapter 5, verses 1 and 2, knowing that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, we have a building of God, an house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. Therefore, in this, we groan earnestly, desiring to be clothed upon with our house which is from heaven. What ails you, Paul, might one have said. May you not take a look at the world? No, he says, for I know that if the earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, I have a house with God, not made with hands, but eternal in the heavens. That is, I know that before long the pins of my tabernacle will be loosed, and it will fall down around my ears, and therefore I must look for another dwelling place. And 1 Corinthians 7:31 says, the fashion of this world passes away. Therefore, he says in verse 32, I would have you without carefulness, caring how to please the Lord. And Philippians 4:5, let your moderation be known unto all men. The Lord is at hand. As if he had said, death is approaching and at hand. Therefore, I entreat you, be sober. But I think many of us will be found like Saul, hid among the stuff. That is, we will be lying among the midst of the pleasures of this passing world. But I say unto you, who are such a one, that death will break the strings of your harp. Your music will quickly cease. Oh, and death will make you have a low esteem of the world. Oh, blessed is the person who has these thoughts of the world all along his way, which he shall have of it at death. Have not the most cursed wretches been forced to cry out, oh, I would give 10,000 worlds for Christ? And have not some persons who have had the moon upon their head and who have made their belly their God been forced to cry out at death, O cursed person that I am, that ever made the world my God. Alas, that I have contented myself with the world. Therefore I say unto you, who are such a one, O stop your pursuit after the world, for death is approaching, and that will cause all your worldly comforts to vanish. Point number four. When a Christian believes this truth, that he must die, it will be an exceeding great restraint to keep him from sinning, as is clear from Job 31:13, compared with verse 14, where Job, thinking over many good deeds done by himself, says, "What then shall I do when God arises up? And when he visits, what shall I answer him?" As if he had said, "Sirs, do not mistake what I say. I am not boasting much of myself, for I could have not done otherwise. Else what should I do when God arises up? How could I answer to God if I had done otherwise?" Now I think it would be a notable practice for each of you to say, "O temptation, what will I answer to God when he arises up to reprove me, if I should yield to you?" Likewise, Ecclesiastes 11:9, where Solomon, dissuading young men to pursue after their vanity, brings this as a reason. "Know you that for all these things God will bring you into judgment? Therefore I say unto you who are often tempted to sin, let death and let reckoning with God be still in your sight. And I defy you to embrace half so many temptations as you now do. I entreat you to answer all your temptations with this word: what shall I do when God rises up? And what shall I answer when he visits me?" Number five. When a Christian lives within the sight of this truth, that he shall once see death, it will make him exceedingly patient under every cross that he meets. Such a Christian will hardly meet with a cross, but he will quiet himself with this: "Death will put me beyond this cross. This is but a cloud that will quickly pass away." And for this cause did David so composedly put up that desire in Psalm 39:4. Saying, "Lord, make me to know mine end and the measure of my days." He was sure that the knowledge of his end would put him in a sober and patient frame. The sixth advantage is this: the faith of approaching death will teach the person that has it to study saving wisdom. And this is clear from Psalm 90, verse 12, where Moses puts up his request, saying, "So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom." As if he had said, "I will never think myself wise till I know that blessed part of arithmetic, how to number my days." And I desire every one of you to think this within yourselves every morning when you rise: "Now I am a day nearer unto eternity than I was before." And at the end of every hour, think, "Now I am an hour nearer unto eternity than I was before." I say, think often. Yes, think this always: "I was never so near my death as I am now. For, oh, are we not all nearer unto eternity today than we were yesterday?" The seventh advantage attending the faith of approaching death is this: that it will make a Christian very careful in preparing for death. It is impossible for one to really believe that death is approaching and not to prepare for it. Say what you will, if you are not careful in preparing for death, you have not the solid faith of this truth that you shall die. Believe me, it is not everyone that thinks he believes this truth that believes it indeed. And how dreadful is it for an unprepared man to meet with death? He desires not to die. Yea, he would give a world for his life, but die he must, whether he will or not. For death will not be requested, so wait a little when he comes. And therefore I say unto you all, set your house in order, for you shall surely die. All men and women, set your house in order, for tomorrow you may die and be cut off in the flower of your age. Think not that there are many that can sell time, for I say, you shall never get time sold unto you. Alas, I fear that for the most part of persons that die now, death finds them unaware. For indeed, the persons that die among us, when we come to visit them, we may give you a sad account of them. For we think they are comprehended under these four sorts. First, when we go to visit some persons on their deathbeds, they are like unto Nabal. Their heart is dying and sinking like unto a stone within them. They are no more affected with death than if it were a daydream. But alas for the great stupidity that has overtaken many. And therefore I entreat you, delay not your repentance till death, lest the Lord take away your wit, so that you cannot repent because of your senseless and stupid frame of spirit. And two, a second sort we find in a presumptuous frame, saying, they have had a good hope all their days, and they will not quit it now. They will go down to their grave with their hope in their right hand, or rather, they will go down to the grave with a lie in their right hand. They live in a presumptuous frame, and they will die in the same delusion. For when we tell them that in all probability they are going down to hell, they answer, God forbid. I was all my time a very honest man or woman. But I love not that confession. For there are many such honest men and women in hell this day. The third sort we find having some convictions that they have been playing the fool all their days. But we can get them no further. I shall only say to such, to go down to the grave with convictions in their breasts, not making use of Christ, is to go down to hell with a candle in their hand, to let them see the way. And truly the greatest part that die in that manner. And fourthly, there are some whom we find in a self-righteous frame, resting upon the covenant of works and their own merits, and trusting by these to go to heaven, yet neglecting the offer of Christ's righteousness. But alas, we find not one of a thousand of this frame, saying, I desire to be dissolved and to be with Christ, which is best of all. And scarcely do we find any in such a frame saying, a wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? Therefore, I say this unto you all who are here. Will you be mindful of death before it takes hold of you? Oh, mind your work now. For you will find that death will be work enough of itself, though you leave no work till then. The eighth advantage that attends the Christian in believing this truth, that once he must die, is this. Death will not be so terrible to him as it is unto many when it comes. What do you think makes death a king of terrors? What makes so many to shake as the leaf of a tree when they are summoned to appear before God's tribunal? It is even because of this They have not been thinking of death before it came, so as to prepare for it. And I fear many in this place may be afraid of death, and that when it comes to them, they will say unto death, as they have said unto Elijah, "Hast thou found me, O my enemy?" Surely death will take you and bring you to the judgment seat of Christ. And therefore study by all means to think often upon it, and make yourselves ready for it. Believe me, death is a very big word. For it will once make you stand with horror in your souls, if your peace be not made with God. I do not know a more dreadful dispensation than death and a guilty conscience meeting together. And with that, we'll end part one of the sermon.
A newsletter and a complimentary copy of our large discount mail order Christian book catalog specializing in Reformation resources, contact Stillwater's Revival Books. On the internet, we are at www.swrb.com. By email, we're at swrb@swrb.com. Our mailing address is 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's Edmonton, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. By phone, 403-450-3730. After February of 1999, our area code will change. We can be reached by phone at 780-450-3730. And keep in mind that William Hetherington, commenting on the Solemn League and Covenant, the epitome of Second Reformation attainments, in his History of the Westminster Assembly of Divines, 1856 edition, page 134, writes, "No man who is able to understand its nature and to feel and appreciate its spirit and aim will deny it to be the wisest, the sublimest, and the most sacred document ever framed by uninspired men."